I call this meeting of the Committee on Health and Human Service Policy to order. It's just me, sorry. We don't have a quorum as of yet, so we will begin by hearing some testimony on the bill from Representative Schultz. We cannot adopt it. I think we're okay. There we go. All right, so we have a quorum present. May I have a motion to approve the minutes for February the 13th, 2019?
So moved.
Representative Freiberg moves approval of the minutes for February the 13th, 2019. Any discussions? Hearing none. Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for February the 13th are approved. So, can I have Representative Schultz to the testifier table? Representative Schultz, please go ahead and move your bill.
So I make the motion to move House File 90, and there is a DE1 amendment.
Okay. So Representative Schultz has a D1 amendment before the committee. Do everyone have that DE1 amendment? Okay,
she needs to move.
So, Representative Schultz, can you please move your amendment?
I'd like to move the DE1 amendment.
Okay. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Schultz, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think I need to clarify where the bill will be moved to.
Please do, Representative Schultz.
It will be moved to Ways and Means. Judiciary, sorry. The motion is to move to the Judiciary Committee. Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is a bill that the legislature has been working on for since December of 2017, when Governor Dayton created a task force to look at elder care and elder abuse in the state of Minnesota. And we've had many advocate groups as part of that task force and the subsequent working group that the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health put together this fall. So I want to first thank the Alzheimer's Association, the Minnesota Elder Justice Center, Elder Voice, Family Advocates, and the Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid for working so diligently and spending a lot of hours on this, as well as the provider groups working with their advocates to solve these issues that we've been hearing about first at the Star Tribune and later through the Office of Health Facility Complaints and Auditor's Report. So, this bill, it's a very large bill, and I think we have Representative Olson is here, not here. So she was going to be presenting. This is the advocate's bill, but I can find my notes and make that presentation until she gets here. So the DE1 addresses many of the issues that we've heard about for the last year and a half, and it focuses on many different items, namely the assisted living licensure and creating the assisted living licensure. Minnesota is a state that has not had historically licensure of assisted living or home-based care with services, support services. And there she is. Liz Olson is here now, so she will take over presenting the DE1, and then we will have our testifiers come up and share their stories, and then we can take questions from members. Does that sound good, Madam Chair?
Sounds good. Great. Representative,
We are in the process of discussing what the DE1 amendment does. So if you can walk us through that amendment, that would be great. Please introduce yourself for the record.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee. We are before this committee today because of the stories from families that you hear, the stories you heard last year in the articles in the Star Tribune in November 2017 reporting widespread and often horrific and unthinkable abuse of older and vulnerable adults living in assisted living establishments and nursing homes. Many of you on this committee have heard testimony from these and other families last year. Many of you are new to the legislature and have not heard these stories. I have no doubt you will find them chilling and compelling. Regulators are still receiving 300 to 400 complaints a month about assisted living establishments and nursing homes. Last year, this legislature addressed the shortcomings of the OHFC investigative process. What got lost in the discussion was the cause of the OHFC being overwhelmed with complaints. OHFC did not create those complaints, and now that the backlog has been addressed, we need to focus our attention.
Representative Olson, could you use the acronym?
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair. The Office of Health Facilities Complaints.
Thank you.
And from here on, I will just say OHFC. That is a mouthful. What we need to focus our attention where it belongs to stop the reasons why the OHFC is continuing to get 300 to 400 complaints a month. What you have before you seeks to address the problem of elder abuse in a systemic, multifaceted way. First, it allows older and vulnerable adults to age in place for as long as possible by setting forth clear rules of the road when facilities can kick them out. Today, resident services can be terminated for any arbitrary reason. Second, it requires when residents must move, it minimizes the number of moves necessary and ensures that residents land in a safe place with minimum amount of trauma. Third, it beefs up the Bill of Rights and gives meaning to those rights by ensuring the residents themselves and their loved ones can enforce the rights we've given them and ensure justice and compensation when wrongs are done. Fourth, it clarifies the residents' right to place a camera to detect and deter abuse. Fifth, it prohibits deceptive marketing, addresses the rampant concerns we hear about families being promised their loved ones will be taken care of throughout the aging process, only to be shocked when the facility fails to deliver on that promise and issues a termination notice. And finally, it creates a licensing structure for assisted living facilities to assure the industry is appropriately regulated. Let me provide a little more detail. In the bill, resident rights are strengthened and expanded. For example, first, the bill adds protection against retaliation for filing a complaint or a maltreatment report. Retaliation is a complaint we have heard across the board from families as one of the things people fear most. In addition, it allows for private enforcement of critical rights, the right to freedom from maltreatment and retaliation, for instance. Existing law, what we have is called the Bill of Rights. That's a powerful term that should mean something, but under current law, it does not hold any significant weight. Today, there is no way for an individual resident to make sure that this is followed, and there's no accountability for violation or justice and compensation when harm is done. This is making a private enforcement of rights crucial. Further, it protects older and vulnerable adults against arbitrary termination in several ways. One, it sets up clear rules regarding the grounds for termination. Two, it provides the right to appeal. Three, it requires that if the resident must leave, sufficient and collaborative discharge planning is done to ensure a safe landing to an appropriate new location. Regarding the electronic monitoring, it clarifies and establishes clear rules for the placement of a camera or other recording device to detect and deter abuse by attempting to balance, one, the resident's right to place a camera, two, everyone's right to privacy, and three, the facility's desire for notification that a camera has been placed in the room. Next, we protect older and vulnerable adults from arbitrary terminations. For many, especially those with dementia or other cognitive impairments, moving is extremely traumatic. Under current law, residents can be discharged to homeless shelters or the street. That is unacceptable. Today, a resident of an assisted living establishment can be kicked out for any reason, there are no protections. By contrast, in nursing home, residents have appeal rights, and nursing homes are required to do discharge planning. There are 28,000 residents in nursing homes. There are more than 60,000 in assisted living establishments. Those 60,000 residents should have the same protections as those in nursing homes. This also requires, before termination notice even could be sent, that an assisted living establishment work with the resident, the resident's representative, the resident's family, applicable agencies, and any relevant health-related or social service professionals to identify and offer reasonable accommodations, interventions, or alternatives to avoid termination. If no accommodation can be made to keep the resident in place, the bill requires that a discharge plan be put together and implemented to reduce the trauma of moving to the extent possible and to ensure a safe and appropriate landing. Finally, it establishes a licensure structure that provides for licensing tiers based on the level of care provided. One, a basic home care tier, two, a comprehensive home care tier, and three, a dementia tier. To respond to what we have heard from the industry, the bill also preserves a housing with service registration, but for a much more limited set of services that require no daily monitoring or any health-related services. Minnesota prides itself on being a leader in so many areas. In this one way, we are an outlier. Regarding licensing, Minnesota is the only state in America that does not license assisted living facilities. Regarding termination protections, 33 states limit grounds for discharge. 24 states provide appeal rights. 25 states require discharge planning to effectuate transfer to a safe and appropriate place. Regarding protections against retaliation, 31 states offer protections against retaliation against residents and family members. 27 states offer protections against retaliation against employees. Regarding private enforcement of rights, 17 states allow a resident, guardian, family member, or other person watching out for the resident to take action in court to enforce some or all of their rights. A lot has happened since last session. Commissioner Malcolm convened a number of working groups in the fall to discuss many of these issues. By all accounts, these meetings were productive and in the area of licensing resulted in a consensus framework for a licensing structure that you'll see in this bill. We look forward to seeing the department's bill in the future and working with the commissioner and her staff, the industry, and the advocates to hone the licensing section and make it workable and effective. Also, the industry and the advocates have been meeting and will continue to meet regularly to iron out their differences and hopefully produce a final bill that can be supported by all. But while our goal is consensus, we can not abandon the fundamental principles that underlie this bill. Protections against arbitrary terminations, giving residents appeal rights, and making sure there is a more robust process for ensuring a safe and appropriate landing should the residents need to move. Strengthening the existing Bill of Rights and putting teeth into the enforcement of the most critical of those rights. Stopping deceptive marketing and ensuring the residents' right to place an electronic monitoring device. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and I'd like to turn it over to the testifiers.
Thank you so much, Representative
Schultz. Madam Chair, I just want to make one more comment.
Okay,
Representative Schultz. I forgot to thank AARP Minnesota in that list, and they've done significant work on this, and also Leading Age Minnesota in the Long-Term Care Imperative. So thank you for assisting with this bill.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Representative Olson, for your testimony. I appreciate it so much. So we have about 11 or 12 testifiers. And so as I call the testifiers down, please come down, introduce yourself, and let's try to be as concise as we can with our testimony so that we can make sure that everyone has an opportunity to share their story with the committee here. I'm going to start off with Jan Malcolm and Dan Pollitt. Commissioner Pollitt, I'm sorry, Commissioner Malcolm and Assistant Commissioner Pollitt. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jan Malcolm, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health. And with me?
Dan Pollock, Assistant Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Services, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We appreciate the opportunity just to give you a sense of what's coming from the administration. Just about an hour ago, the governor released his budget proposal, which contains important resources to continue the work of improving our operations on the regulatory front under current law, as well as enabling us to move forward with the policy reforms that Representative Schultz and Representative Olson just outlined. We're very gratified by the governor's support of the importance of this issue. We do believe that this is the year to get this done, that there's been a lot of good work by all stakeholders that will allow us to get this over the finish line at the end of the day. We, of course, the timeline has been a bit of a challenge with the budget just coming out today. So tomorrow, actually, we'll be able to share actual bill language with the advocates and with interested legislators. It's been our goal, and I've communicated with the legislative authors on this front, that before presenting an administration bill to you, we would get some feedback from the consumers and the providers and try to bring you language that reflects really the best of the ideas that are floating in various vehicles at this point. So I can give you just a quick sense of what the governor's budget is built around and what the policy proposal from the administration will be. It's highly similar in terms of the key components to what you just heard from Representative Schultz and Olson. I think the goals and the objectives are extremely well aligned. There will be some differences in language and in timeline, but I think we've got a lot to work with. On the first part of the governor's budget request was to improve operations and systems under current law that will allow us to enhance our capacity to enforce regulations, to modernize our case management system, to invest in much more data analysis and reporting so that we can make better use of all the information flowing through our systems, as well as to strengthen communication and engagement with all stakeholders. In terms of the regulatory reforms and enhanced protections, we too will bring you a proposal on an assisted living licensure framework and an expansion of consumer protections in a number of ways. Quite similarly to what you heard from Representative Schultz and Olson, the assisted living licensure proposal is around three tiers of licensure for assisted living: a basic assisted living license, a comprehensive assisted license, and then a third tier, which we've referred to as Comprehensive Plus, which creates additional certification standards for dementia care. Very importantly, in our framework, all of these licenses would require that the housing and services provided in the housing facility be accountable through a single license. So that does a lot to create more transparency, more accountability, and more ease of navigation for consumers. In interest of time, Madam Chair, I won't go through all the rest of the provisions, but we'll be just wanted to pledge to you that we're now ready with the governor's budget support to begin sharing the actual language, which we will begin to do tomorrow.
Thank you so much for your testimony.
Madam Chair, I'll be very brief. Just wanted to really thank the committee for taking a comprehensive approach to the vulnerable adult issue. As Commissioner Malcolm has mentioned, the two agencies have been working really closely together on this issue for almost a year now, and I think have really made tremendous progress in terms of being able to speak with one voice, and that's reflected in the governor's budget and the bill language that you'll see tomorrow. Without getting into all the details, it is really important from our perspective of human services to not just do regulation of the industry, but also consider the population and the adult protection system. Some of the bills last year really focused on the agency regulatory improvements, but did not do enough to address the whole system, which, you know, is county, it's human services, it's health, it's all three as lead investigative agencies. So I think the bill that is moving forward here, Representative Schultz and Representative Olson have already articulated, is a really great comprehensive approach, and we look forward to working with you in the session on this.
Well, thank you, sir. And it's really good to see different departments working together to bring one voice and some solutions to this huge problem that we have here in the state of Minnesota. and to realize that solutions really do come through a more comprehensive lens. So I just want to thank you for leading in that area. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Beth McMullen and Chris Sunberg.
Hi, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is Chris Sunberg from, was I to go first?
Go first.
Okay, sorry. I'm president of Elder Voice Family Advocates, and we are primarily a group of people who've come together after a horrific experience, usually with a mother, father, but sometimes an aunt, uncle, or even occasionally a child. In my case, my father's body was left for 7 days without ever doing a wellness check. They said they would do wellness checks if he didn't come to a meal. But, sorry, I talked about this so often, I don't know why it still does get me. Anyway, newspapers had been piling up outside of his door. A neighbor went and said, "You need to check on him. I haven't seen him." Well, that didn't happen. He didn't come for a meal during that whole time. But I'm not the only one who has had a really horrific experience. A lot of our members have had loved ones who died or had limbs amputated because of untreated infections, ignored emergency conditions, repeated failure to feed and give basic care, and much more. Others report sexual assaults by other residents and sometimes even staff. There are also many instances of broken bones, bruises, festering sores, and abrasions that are the result of physical abuse, mishandling, or neglect. We painfully learned that there's very little oversight in the assisted living residence, even though this has been the fastest growing part of the senior living industry. This was also verified by the legislative auditor after they did the review of the Office of Health Facilities complaints. In their report, they stated, quote, "Minnesota's ability to hold housing with services establishments, that's assisted living, accountable for maltreatment is limited. We don't license assisted living, therefore have few regulator tools to protect our elders and vulnerable adults." We believe this under-regulation has led to an epidemic growth in abuse. In 2010, there were 4,000 complaints registered. Last year, there were 22,500 complaints. That's at a rate of 400 per week still coming in. Since bringing this to the forefront over the last couple of years, we've been told by some that what has happened to us is really rare. I'm sorry, it is not rare. It is a growing epidemic. You don't have 22,500 reports of abuse and call that rare. And keep in mind that abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation is significantly underreported. The National Center for Victims of Crimes state as few as 1 in 24 cases of elder abuse is reported to authorities. Some residents and families just purely don't know they can do that, and others, as been mentioned before, fear the retaliation. We have one family down in Albert Lea right now going through a very painful situation. They were being asked to leave their residence, which was a assisted living, about a week ago, even though there had really been no change in the condition of the person. And the spouse is a retired physician, so I think he's fairly knowledgeable about such things. Also, then there are the poor souls who just don't have anybody there to help them advocate for themselves when they're not able to do it themselves. Another claim that we hear is that the OAHFC only investigates the serious complaints, and most of the others are frivolous. Well, it is true that they only investigate about 5% on-site, and another 5% is a desk audit, leaving about 90% that never get an investigation. But that does not mean that 90% aren't very serious issues. When we look at that, we're seeing a lot of very serious issues going on. One investigator told one of our members that, in his words, inconclusive is based on what they think they know. They think they know something happened, but they just don't have the hard evidence to prove it. Additionally, we need to be aware of how underfunded our regulatory agencies have been. OHFC has been under-resourced in terms of both staff and technology. Our ombudsman ranks almost dead last in the nation in terms of the number of beds they are expected to cover. Our ombudsman is expected to cover 9,000 beds. The recommended standard is 2,000. In your packets, we left the findings from our initial review of OHFC studies, and I won't go through all of that. But it's the beginning. We wanted to look at these to get a feel for what's really happening. And in our minds, these are very shocking. There are some operators out there who maintain their facilities so poorly that the residents with dementia are able to escape, leave, you know, and I don't mean to escape in terms of it trickiness. They opened the door and left, only to be later found in a snowbank, drowned in a pond, fallen, and had a serious concussion and later died. And there are so many other situations where staff are just poorly trained or they're just understaffed. They just cannot keep up with the demands. And the result is an incorrect use of equipment or poor medication administration, and all of these can result in very catastrophic situations. The things that probably are even the hardest to understand is the cruelty that we're seeing in some of these areas. One of the reports, a man fell on the floor, was left for 4 hours to crawl through his own feces on the floor while the staff looked at him, ignored him, watched TV, and read magazines. Another case that we all probably read about a few weeks ago up in Hill City, a man was beaten, ultimately to death, while a couple of other staff people held him down during the beating. Other staff ignored it, and then they would not get him treatment for many days, and he died as a result. We just ask that you take this legislation very seriously. And we know that assisted living licensure will establish standards that will take us a long way in preventing some of these situations from happening. And the resident rights will also assure accountability and ultimately reduce the number of these problems. Finally, I want to say thank you to the very good operators out there. I don't mean this to sound like we think all of them are bad. They aren't. And we need them, and thank you for your attention.
And thank you. To the testifier, please introduce yourself for your record and who you are.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth McMullen, and I'm with the Alzheimer's Association. I appreciate the opportunity to speak today on House File 90, the Delete All Amendment, and I want to thank Representatives Schultz and Olson for their steadfast commitment to improving safety and quality of care in long-term care facilities. The Alzheimer's Association is the world's leading voluntary health organization in Alzheimer's care, support, and research. We work to advance public policies at the state and federal level to improve lives of all those affected by Alzheimer's, those living with dementia, as well as their caregivers. Among our state policy priorities are a couple of areas central to the discussion today: building a dementia-capable workforce, enhancing quality of care in residential settings, and protecting people living with dementia from abuse, neglect, and maltreatment. Attention to these priorities is reflected in the bill before you today, requiring dementia training for those who work in these settings and protecting people with dementia from being improperly displaced from residential settings. The Alzheimer's Association was one of the five consumer stakeholder groups called together by Governor Dayton in 2017 to make recommendations to improve care and safety for vulnerable adults in nursing homes and assisted living settings. Last fall, as Commissioner Malcolm pulled together the multiple work groups to build on the momentum from the 2018 session, I was pleased to serve at her request as the convener of the Dementia Standards Work Group. That broad group of stakeholders worked together to find consensus where we could and to identify and dig into areas of disagreement to better understand our differences. We understand that the department, as the commissioner mentioned, has taken these recommendations from the work groups and that these recommendations are included in the governor's budget, and I understand the author is willing to look at and consider that recommended language when it's released. I support that consideration as we believe it'll reflect the work of so many stakeholders on these critical issues. Very high level, the Dementia Standards Work Group identified three high-level recommendations to guide our work. One, people living with Alzheimer's disease and other dementia are not required to reside in dementia care settings. Two, there should be additional license or certification requirements, i.e. minimum standards, for dementia care settings. And three, since people with dementia will live in all types of long-term care settings, assisted living settings should meet minimum dementia training requirements. These high-level dementia standards recommendations are generally reflected in the bill today. Also in the bill are provisions on electronic monitoring. While placement of electronic monitoring device alone does not ensure safe quality care, nor should it replace other means of prevention or detection of abuse, it can be a useful tool. People with dementia are especially vulnerable to the because the disease may make it difficult or even prevent them from communicating about abuse or even recognizing it. We believe it's important to clarify these complex issues in Minnesota law to allow these types of devices. Finally, for people living with dementia, changes in routine, living, and care arrangements can be very disruptive, leading to declining health. There are a number of issues in this bill that are critical components of consumer protections that will help minimize disruptions in living and care arrangements whenever possible. Policies related to resident assessments, involuntary discharges and terminations, appeal rights, discharge planning, these are all critical to ensure consumer protections for vulnerable adults. I also want to highlight a couple of the recommendations from the Alzheimer's Disease Working Group, which was created and funded by the legislature 2 years ago. And the report was delivered to the legislature last month. Particularly related to this discussion today on the provisions in this bill, the Alzheimer's Disease Working Group recommended reviewing, strengthening, and expanding rights of vulnerable adults living in long-term care settings, including enhancing criminal and civil enforcements when violations occur. The working group also recommended clearly defining dementia standards across all settings. And finally, the working group also called for creation of an assisted living license with clear enforcement standards. There are a total of 18 policy recommendations, and I hope to have an opportunity in the future to speak with you about those, but I won't go into more detail. I look forward to working with the author as this bill moves forward to ensure that we have strong dementia standards in place and that we protect people living with dementia from being improperly displaced. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your testimony. Okay, our next testifier will be Kate Boomerkamp and Connie Bildmeier. And please reintroduce yourself for the record and then proceed.
Sure. Okay. I'm not Connie. I'm Lauren Edstrom, but
okay,
Connie couldn't be here right now.
Connie's not here? Okay. All right. Lauren, please.
Sure. Thank you for the chance to do this here today. My mother has dementia, and I am her sole caregiver. We made the transition from independent living to an assisted living setting. It was primarily for social inclusion. My mom was still driving and caring for herself, but she was just becoming isolated with some of the memory troubles. When you depend on the elderly waiver to subsidize your housing, your options are very limited. There's many buildings out there, but very few rooms. And when I found a new building that had just opened its doors, I jumped at the chance to take my mom for a tour. She was hesitant, obviously, about moving, but I'm not able to empathize with her to what that move was going to mean to her. I just wanted her to be safe and happy and have someone that she could rely on when she needed it if I wasn't around. During my tour of this building, looking back as a naive caregiver, I was trusting them to tell me everything that I needed to know about a move of this magnitude. This is their industry, not mine. This was outside my wheelhouse. And I was hoping that they had been trained properly to be resources to the families of the residents that they were going to be welcoming. I brought my mom by for a tour. She picked her room. It was a beautiful place. There were promises of trips, you know, to the grocery store, to Target. They would have a bus, movie night, activities with the other residents. I didn't know the questions that I needed to ask. I was hoping that they would provide that for me, since, again, I'm not an expert in this. And none of the promises above ever happened. I didn't ask questions like, how many overnight staff do you have working? I didn't ask questions about, how are you going to help my mom transition if she gets lost in the hallway? I didn't ask, you know, how many chances is she going to get before you feel like this isn't the right environment for her? It seemed too good to be true. I called so many other places, and this was the best option, and the brightest, and the newest. So I had really no choice, like many other families, but to trust that what they were telling me and that they were being truthful. I was wrong, and it became very clear with unreturned phone calls to wellness, the executive director, just light staff, and not anybody ever around if I needed to have them help me answer a question. I would leave work. I would bring my infant son to help my mom find her way back from the elevator. I would make sure her phone is charged so that I could walk her on the phone how to get back to her room. The hallways were very long. It was a very nice building, but I couldn't track people down, and if I was new, like some of these people are, with the neutral color paints, the signs, there's nothing telling anybody where the dining room was or where they needed to go, and people with and without memory issues were getting lost in this big new building, and there just, again, wasn't anybody around to help them redirect and find their way back. That responsibility falls on the families. We went on a tour with someone that worked for this company, and, I mean, their job is to fill the rooms. That's it. If they don't fill rooms, they don't have a job. As caregivers, typically there's an emergency. In my situation, there was not. But these decisions that we're making for these moves are usually made quickly. And when we're relying on these people to tell us the truth and offer up information and insight that we don't have in a trying situation, this is just kind of the ultimate letdown. Even when it's not an emergency, I'm not qualified to know all I needed to know upon this tour. I'm 35. Again, I have a little kid. But I knew where to look for some of these things because I work at Meals on Wheels. I knew some of the resources that I have, and some of the people within my network were able to help me. Not everybody has that. Trying to figure out where some of these unsubstantiated and substantiated claims are from the people that are just complainers to the people that really have problems, I didn't know where to look for that until it was too late. All that information is very difficult to find, and again, I knew where to dig. I lost time with my family. I felt guilty that I had done this to my mom because she was relatively fine before she moved. And like Beth said, I was unaware of what a transition like this would mean. Had it been done properly, maybe it would have ended differently. But the toll that it took on her, I'm not going to get that time back. In 10 months that she was in this setting, and it felt incredibly long, even though it was very short, my mother was lied to, she was neglected, she was bullied, she was stolen from, and her health suffered tremendously. Her debit card was taken from her room, and there was a police report, and the person was terminated, and they admitted that they had done it, but there was no charges filed, and nothing was ever flagged on their name, because they didn't actually use her debit card. They just had it. So this person can go and get a job in another assisted living facility, because technically they didn't do anything wrong. I have a problem with that. We're not buying cars, you know. We just want to know that there's qualified staff looking out for our loved ones in a safe and caring environment. I don't want to be told what I want to hear. I just want to, and I get that it's a business, right? But we need to put resident safety above aesthetics and filling rooms, and I'm not sure that these companies are going to do that unless somebody makes them. So until then, basically, I felt like I moved my mom onto a cruise ship without a captain, and my son's daycare is regulated more than my mom's living facility, and he doesn't sleep overnight there. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Kay?
Yep. My name is Kay Brummelkamp. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for listening to my testimony today in support of electronic monitoring. 5 months after our mother's death, our family received a letter from the director of OHFC, quote, Unfortunately, the current and projected workforce shortage decreases the available number of staff to work with vulnerable adults. This increases the possibility that staff hired are not always suited to this line of work. That is why it is so important for vulnerable persons to have strong family advocates. Your mother was extremely lucky to have you and your family intervening in her care. If your loved one was paying up to $7,000 a month, residing in a facility owned by Minnesota's largest provider, I believe we all would expect proper care. Not everyone has family to monitor and intervene for them. We tried hard for 18 months to work with the facility and its management and staff to address our concerns. I want to let you know how we came to install a camera, which is not done lightly by a family. In addition to our mom's claims, we had our own observations. Unexplained bruises, unshowered at times, unchanged depends, safety sensors unplugged, finding our mom alone in her room while all the other residents were eating dinner, many mornings still in bed, none of her cares had been given, the activity director stating that our private caregivers are intentionally keeping our mom secluded in her room. It became obvious to us her care plan was not being followed or was not accurate, as we had not had a private caregiver for over 6 weeks. If you can imagine the trauma we felt of not believing our mom when she would state, "My arms hurt, they're mean to me," or she can't remember how she got a bruise or how she fell, that she was hungry or wasn't fed, or telling us, "There's a man that sleeps at the end of my bed in a chair." To this day, we are haunted as we attributed these comments to her dementia. We were not believed, our concerns were minimized, and we were repeatedly told that the care was checked off on her chart, so therefore it was done. But most important, our vulnerable mom was not being properly cared for. When learning that the facility had cameras in the hallways and common areas, a light bulb went off. Why not put a camera in my mom's own private room? Fearing retaliation, we sat on this idea for over a month. I would now like to share with you the horror we found the first 3 days of camera observation. Dentures and face not cleaned for 3 days, no showers, no escorts to meals, which often meant no meal. We discovered the morning aide would come in, lock the door, stay and watch TV and or sleep and not provide cares or a meal for a mother. That was the man sleeping at the end of my mother's bed. No medications given, skip safety checks at night. Hands not washed once in 3 days, the hands that toileted herself. By day three, emotional and physical abuse. Being roughed up as the aide dresses her, snapping her bra and stating, yes, she knows she's being rough with her as my mom is so frustrating and repeatedly hits our mom's leg. She's yelled at and called a grown-ass adult over 3 times and telling her she's acting like a child. I want you to know as we are watching this, we would flee from our homes or work and intervene and provide the cares ourselves. Once the camera was noticed on day 4, they began to take my mom out of the room, and we were greatly relieved that she was finally getting socialization and participating in activities. Little did we know she was shoved in a corner by herself, unattended, and out of view of the camera. Thankfully, another resident's daughter alerted us to this. When she shared this with the director, asking her, how do you think the Horgan family would feel about their mother? She said, she can ambulate. My mom was in a wheelchair by that time. We were appalled when we received an email a few weeks later from the director stating, unless we communicate everything regarding our mother's care, that her care will continue to be below our standards. Many different arguments for and against electronic monitoring have been brought forth. I would like to address three. First, notification. Requiring a resident with dementia to witness and be part of the notification process is cruel. Here is a person with a confused mind, and now we're going to put a thought in their head that they may not be safe. Please understand how often those with dementia ruminate and obsess about an idea or a thought. It would not surprise me if we had done that, that my mother would have digressed and possibly been one of the residents you read about in the paper that elopes from a facility undetected, found wandering, or worse yet, dead in a snowbank, blocked from their facility. Privacy. As you listen to these concerns for privacy, please consider from whom this argument is coming. Until my sister broke up a staff fight in front of a dozen residents, did we learn that the facility had, for years, been monitoring common areas without notice to residents or families. Please understand that once a vulnerable adult enters assisted living, it is because they need assistance with daily cares. Thus, their privacy becomes secondary to safe care. It is not uncommon to have a float aide or a temporary agency aid providing the most private of cares, such as bathing and toileting. We know our mother would have wanted safety over perceived privacy. Retaliation. By day four, after the assault on our mom, the facility was well aware we had a camera. We will never know if it was poor care, lack of staff, or outright retaliation that permitted the facility, because we had a camera, on three different occasions within 3 weeks, for 16, 18, and 19 hours each time, to disregard our mother as she lay in her own soil with no food, liquids, or depends change. And since we're talking about notification, we notified the entire organization management chain of command via email after each of these three incidents. We wish we would have put a camera in sooner, as we most likely could have prevented the rapid decline she endured due to her abuse, neglect, and maltreatment. We wish we could have just been daughters. We're trying not to look back, but rather look forward by focusing on care, dignity, and protecting the rights of our most vulnerable. When we made the decision to move our mother to assisted living, our two guiding principles were that she were kept safe and that she felt our constant love. She was loved. Thank you for this opportunity to speak for strong electronic monitoring laws.
All right. Thank you. And don't look back. You did what you thought you needed to do. You love your mom. So we have the next testifier is Eric Lynn and Mary Jo George. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, I'm Eric Lynn, members of the committee. Thank you today for allowing me to testify. My mother, Irene, was diagnosed with Alzheimer's at the age of 58. My mom passed away in April of 2017 at the age of 65. Our mother was a caregiver herself, working as a nurse's aide for 20 years. After diagnosis in 2009, she lost her job, her privilege to drive, her home, her dog. Mom was a caregiver through and through to many. She raised five boys after a tragic farm accident, took the life of our young father, Ron. Yet when it came time for her to be cared for, we discovered that the facilities where she would live and the staff that worked there had little understanding of her needs as a person living with Alzheimer's. They promised us quality care but failed to provide basic care. They assured us they had proper security measures, but she was able to leave unattended, eventually discharged and rejected from what was her home. You make the very difficult decision to move your mother to an assisted living or what you think is a memory care facility with knowledge of Alzheimer's. Your belief is that the care facility is surely licensed, has professional caregivers that have been well-trained and well-mentored. After all, this is what the brochure states. This is what the website shows. You finally convince yourself and the family to visit a facility. You're greeted by the manager and shown a beautiful leather couch and a stone fireplace, the promise of home-cooked meals, relaxing bath time, and an overall wonderful experience. But what is the reality? 5 months into Mom's stay at the first facility, she wandered away. She crossed a major county road before being discovered by a vigilant neighbor. This traumatic experience involving police, fire, ambulance led to a trip to the ER, and then a 10-day stay at a psychiatric hospital, all due to an undetected urinary tract infection. Then upon discharge, the facility stated they would not readmit Mom and canceled our housing agreement. We were given 24 hours to take Mom home or find another facility. We had no appeal rights and no plan to help her safely transition to the next facility. We found another memory care assisted living, but the incompetent care was difficult to accept, and we, her family, provided many of the basic cares the facility was unable to provide. They referred to our mother as C3, her room number. Can you imagine your own mother being called C3 in front of you, and your siblings, and your mom, and her grandkids? Mom eventually became over-medicated on a very strong dose of Haldol. This was one of the many times we experienced medication errors throughout her stay. The third facility under a competent, compassionate RN gave our family hope. Mom's condition improved and she actually rebounded. Less medication, she began to eat on her own and gain weight for a brief time. Mom was alert and responsive. But 3 months later, that RN was chewed up by an administrator who cared about filling beds and charging for everything possible. We were right back to daily challenges, lack of leadership, and Mom's condition would soon show the effects. We again took shifts to care for Mom. Our aunt also helped, logged over 700 hours giving Mom baths and feeding her. Never a day went by when we were not there to help care for Mom. This while we paid full price, not once, never once, a thank you from an administrator or leadership. imagine this very same facility Mom worked at for 20 years as a young woman. In Mom's dying days under a hospice care plan the med plan, the facility failed to communicate and follow the med plan to keep Mom comfortable. We were forced to take Mom to my home to die, to assure dignity under our watch. Every dollar our mother worked for, saved, went to three facilities. She paid to be neglected over and over again, and threats of eviction became common, even weekly, in each facility. This is a very abbreviated version of our story, spanning over 7 years. Mom was a resident in assisted living. Several moves, including the psychiatric stay, many hours of lost work, lost sleep, hardship endured by her family, as well as unappreciated good caregivers put in positions they were not trained or qualified for. Families like ours can no longer wait for proper protection to be put into place to protect our loved ones. Our mother's suffering has ended. However, families are still experiencing the very same nightmare as we sit here today. My fight has not ended. Our story could happen to anybody in this room today. A terminal diagnosis that devastates you with no notice and no cure, or just old age, that brings you to a new chapter in life and you become dependent on others to live out your years. Your life savings shouldn't pay for neglect and abuse. We all deserve a life of dignity and respect, a life of person-centered care that assures you your safety and life of no threats of displacement. I've testified several times last year, even staying late into the night with other families to tell their stories that never get easier to speak about. I've recently represented families on the Preparing Minnesota for Alzheimer's work group, which has been presented to the legislatures. I have met with legislatures in my home and greater Minnesota. The cross her mother carried and the pain endured by her and many others like her is unimaginable to most. It continues to be the reason I share our story with hope it can make a difference. The time has come to prohibit misleading advertising and empty promises. Protect our most vulnerable from being kicked out of their homes. Commit to a license structure that protects those living in assisted livings and memory care facilities. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mary Jo George, and I'm the Associate State Director of AARP Minnesota. AARP represents over 670,000 members in the state, and on their behalf, we appreciate the opportunity to testify today on House File 90. Some of our members are in the room, as you can see. Preventing elder abuse is AARP's top priority this year, and we want to thank both Representative Olson and Representative Schultz for their leadership on this issue. We also want to thank the industry and Commissioner Malcolm and Assistant Commissioner Pollack and all of the stakeholders who have been working over the interim to address how we can improve the care of residents in nursing homes and assisted living. But most of all, today, we want to thank the families for sharing their heartfelt stories of their pain and their suffering and for their work to help us to improve these laws. Sorry, I'm getting so emotional after talking to all of them and listening to the stories. Today, older Minnesotans living in assisted living have more complex care needs than when these options first became available more than two decades ago. And as you've heard, few protections exist for these individuals, and Minnesota is an outlier from other states that require more public oversight. As Representative Olson stated, House File 90 will provide both broad systemic reforms that address not only assisted living licensure, but also to strengthen the rights of older and vulnerable adults. At AARP, we believe that assisted living licensure is critical, and we are very pleased that there is a consensus around the framework for licensure. However, we do not think public oversight alone is sufficient to deter abuse. It is also absolutely critical that we strengthen the rights of vulnerable adults and to provide these protections now, as licensure we think could take another year or even up to 2 years to implement. As you heard the stories today of the families, I thought I could quickly just summarize again how the bill will impact and improve their lives. First and foremost, we believe the bill will address a significant imbalance of power and the vulnerabilities felt by older adults and their families. It'll do this by prohibiting retaliation and maltreatment and giving vulnerable adults the right to use the courts to obtain justice when they are harmed. As you heard from some of the testifiers, the bill will also give vulnerable adults the right to place a camera to monitor and deter abuse without fear of retaliation by the facility. No doubt these protections may have helped prevent the abuse that Kay's mother experienced and that other family members have experienced. And if we can act this year, they will help prevent additional and painful and tragic losses like these in the future. In addition, the bill prohibits deceptive and aggressive marketing practices that we see at the time of move-in. This was experienced by Lauren and Eric and Chris's family. Moreover, the bill will provide clear definitions, standards, and staff training will be required of facilities that hold themselves out as providing dementia care. Also, under the new licensure framework, as Chris Sundberg and her family could have had some peace of mind knowing that the facility her dad lived in would have been licensed and under the purview of the health department. Today's senior housing facilities that offer just daily wellness checks and health monitoring have no oversight by our state. Finally, last but not least, to address the traumatic discharges that Eric Lynn and his mother experienced, the bill provides the much needed protections against arbitrary discharge and appeal rights. Too often, I think we heard today, assisted living facilities say they can no longer care for you because you're beyond their scope. But families, unfortunately, it's become a catch-all phrase, but families don't know what it means. We think under licensure, people will have better admissions, will have better admission protections, and will know what services, but we need these rights now because it's very important to protect and prevent traumatic discharges. After meeting with and listening to the concerns of the industry, we think the bill does strike a balance in that it allows for emergency discharges and establishes clear guidelines for terminations and expedited appeal rights. If the facility it determines that the facility can no longer care for you, there are requirements for discharge planning, so families would not have to scramble in the middle of the night like Eric did for his mother, Irene. Today, we do offer these termination and discharge rights to vulnerable adults in nursing homes and adults in group homes. Given the vulnerability of this population, we need them for this population as well. In conclusion, we know preventing abuse is a shared Minnesota value, and we are committed to working together with all the stakeholders to develop both licensure and to strengthen the rights. Thank you.
All right. Thank you both for your testimony again. So we have Toby Pearson and Libby Chapurin.
Madam Chair, please, members of the committee.
Welcome to the committee.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. My name is Libby Chapurin. I'm from Leading Age Minnesota, and I'm here today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. The stories of harm and abuse that we heard today were terrible. They were intolerable. Even one instance of harm is too many and must be addressed. That's why I want to thank Commissioner Malcolm and MDH for bringing all the stakeholders together over the interim to discuss the important issues raised today in the stories you heard, and to try to attempt to identify workable solutions that can move us forward this legislative session. The long-term care imperative is fully participated in those discussions, and we found, as we've long expected, that we have significant common ground with consumers and regulators alike. The work group identified several shared values and principles that should guide this important work this session. Number one, it's important to maintain choice and flexibility in assisted living. Minnesota has been nationally recognized for promoting choice and flexibility. These are not institutions. They are home and community-based services, and we should not seek to create more nursing homes. Number two, seniors should be able to live independently for as long as they are able with access to safe, quality care in the communities they call home. Number three, there are many perspectives that need to be considered, as we work together to ensure that we have a system that balances the values of independence and choice with the desire for safety and protection. Number four, whatever laws are passed this session, we need to ensure that there's adequate resources for implementation and enforcement. New regulations must also include clear enforcement mechanisms. And last but not least, prevention should also be a key focus of the work. We should ensure that there's an infrastructure in place to use the data collected to help inform prevention efforts, and this should be included in this year's efforts as well. To be clear, the long-term care imperative supports assisted living licensure with specific criteria for evaluation, disclosures, service terminations. We support increased dementia care standards. We support electronic monitoring. We support strengthened protections for consumers against retaliation and deceptive marketing. However, we look forward to our continued work with stakeholders to find solutions that more closely reflect the emerging consensus that came out of the working groups in the interim discussions. I'd like to thank Representative Schultz and Representative Olson for your leadership on these issues. We look forward to the continued discussion this legislative session.
Great. Thank you so much for your testimony. Yes, please introduce yourself and welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson with Care Providers of Minnesota, also with the Long-Term Care Imperative. I get to play bad cop to Libby's good cop. First, as we said, we support moving to assisted living licensure. There's no question about that. However, how we move to that, the details really matter. There are many provisions brought forth by this bill which we support, as Libby outlined. They were discussed in the interim working groups, and a lot of work was done that was very good work moving forward. However, for those provisions that we find operationally challenging, we are hopeful there can be resolution during this legislative session. We have a responsibility to identify the possible and potential unintended consequences of these proposals and the provisions where the businesses could close because they cannot meet the standard, or where their financing arrangements are at risk, where provisions which would result in consumers experiencing no access to the services they want, and provisions that make it impossible to meet with the current workforce shortage. Our first highlight is the provision that says that we must take all payer sources. The language incorrectly assumes that all providers are enrolled and eligible to accept all payment sources, including publicly funded programs such as Medicaid, as well as private insurance. It also does not consider whether the payment offered will be sufficient to cover the needed level of services. Currently, the Elderly Waiver Program, which is the Medicaid program, is severely underfunded at up to about 25% below the costs, according to a recent DHS study. Furthermore, clients on EW have budget caps that may limit the amount of services that they can adequately cover. Second area I'd like to highlight. Although we agree there should be an appeals process and service termination process for both housing and services, the current one is unworkable. The biggest concern is that there's no time frame for hearing resolution, and the assisted living must still take care of the individual. The assisted living establishment bears the burden of proof to establish the termination of housing or services as permissible. Potentially, this could delay the resolution of situations that are unsafe. There's a big question of who will care for a resident that has initiated this process if a provider has said that it can no longer care for the resident. There's also concern that this new process is in addition to current landlord-tenant law. There needs to be one single process for reconsideration. Potentially, under this language, a resident could pursue an appeal through the Office of Administrative Hearings, or OAH, and not prevail, but then turn around and file another claim in housing court to extend the stay even longer. While we agree in concept with some form of appeal in the new license arena, the language has too many problems in its current form. Another area is the overly broad definition of deceptive marketing and retaliation. The providers are not opposed to greater protections for either of these situations, but the language appears to be overly broad. For example, with respect to deceptive marketing, it would apply to any misleading statements or representations by any employee. Recollections of verbal interactions are not reliable, which is why written contracts are utilized. Additionally, there are numerous existing state laws for consumer protection from deceptive marketing, including laws prohibiting false advertising and deceptive trade practices. We think it should be modified to be written rather than verbal. With respect to retaliation, the language would apply to acts against a resident, employee, or person with a familial, personal, legal, or professional relationship with the patient or resident, which is quite a broad universe of people when you start to think about it. Under the language, the provider is presumed guilty of retaliation for any long list of actions taken within 90 days of an initial complaint. This would include an increase in necessary services if the resident's condition changed, the discharge of a resident if their care needs exceeded the provider's ability to administer them. And it would even potentially prevent the termination or discipline of an employee who self-reports maltreatment of an incident and therefore has 90 days before they could be acted upon. The lengthy list of retaliatory actions does not take into account the frequent changes in service needs for the senior population served in these settings. Several of the actions considered retaliatory could actually put seniors at greater risk for maltreatment. Another problematic component is that we would be inviting more lawsuits when there actually is no quantifiable damages. One of the issues in there is invites lawsuits where no quantifiable damages have occurred. Currently, plaintiffs who have suffered actual personal damages have the right to sue and exercise that right. The current law allows you to sue for certain actions even though there were no quantifiable damages and recover up to $3,000 or whichever your damages were, whichever is more. The lack of right to privacy and provider notification and electronic monitoring continues to be a concern. Much of the electronic monitoring language has been agreed upon with the exceptional work that took place over the summer and the fall, and it is really down to one area where we have notice. We think that because of our responsibility to help protect the privacy and the dignity of the residents and to hopefully prevent any maltreatment from occurring, the facility should receive notice when you're putting a camera in. Finally, overall, the bill appears to essentially apply assisted living to all of the current nursing facility oversight language relating to controlling persons, receiverships, licensure, suspension, revocation without acknowledging that assisted living buildings may be owned by entities not affiliated with the assisted living services or may have different financing models that may be put at risk with overbroad language. We support licensure but want to ensure that we are not simply creating new nursing homes or making all assisted livings look more like nursing homes. Any licensure framework does need to continue to promote consumer choice and access and person-centered care. We pledge our support to continue meeting with the authors and advocates to work towards a consensus on as many of these issues as possible. It's our hope that the process will allow for an open dialogue and resolution of the different perspectives through negotiations, and that there will be final legislation on older adult protections signed into law this year. This work is too important, and even one case of abuse is too many, and we must do better. We apologize for all the bad actors out there, and the providers continue to pledge to keep working to do better for the residents whom we serve. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Sean Burke.
Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony. And tell us who you're with.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members. My name is Sean Burke. I'm the Public Policy Director at the Minnesota Elder Justice Center. Our organization is a statewide nonprofit working to prevent and alleviate the abuse and neglect and financial exploitation of older and vulnerable adults. We know that 1 in 10 older adults will be a victim of elder abuse during their lifetime. And for older adults with cognitive issues and impairments, that risk increases to 1 in 5. Our staff work across the state. We provide free, confidential support and services to victims of elder abuse and their families. We provide professional training and education to those working with or on behalf of older adults. And we work collaboratively to change systems that impact older victims. We want to thank Representative Schultz and Olson for their commitment to protecting older and vulnerable adults in Minnesota. As you heard earlier from Representative Schultz, our organization was one of the 5 consumer groups tasked with developing recommendations for changes to our long-term care system back in 2017. We are pleased to see many of those recommendations have been incorporated and refined into the DE1 amendment of House File 90. And we support the changes that you've heard the other consumer groups and advocates and families discuss earlier today. One additional area to highlight as this discussion moves forward involves an issue that was not discussed as much this past fall among the working groups, but it was at the core of what the families were talking about today. As our state moves forward with new assisted living license, perhaps no issue has a more direct connection to the health, safety, and quality than staffing levels. Research indicates strong correlations between sufficiently trained and staffed facilities with high marks for safety and quality. Some states regulate staffing levels with prescribed ratios, for example, 1 to 12 or 1 to 25. We believe a better route is to mandate that facilities have a working plan, a plan that would justify their staffing levels, that would be based on assessment of the residents and a census of who they're admitting. We look forward to working on this and many of the other great protection issues in this bill. And again, many thanks to Representative Schultz and Olson. We are pleased to continue to work with all the stakeholders to make sure residents in our long-term care facilities have strong rights and protection. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. Do we have anyone in the audience who would like to testify to the bill? Okay. Let's open up to members. Any questions? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm glad to see a comprehensive bill being brought forward because I think it's been overdue, and while it's long and complicated, I think lives are complicated, and some of them have been shortened when the care hasn't been there that people have counted on. This summer, I took time to participate in one of the MDH work groups on assisted living licensing, and I did that because Liz Olson, who's our lead on the issue, isn't going to be able to come down from Duluth to do that. And I appreciate the opportunities that I had to learn from all the people, both from the industry and from the advocacy community on it, and to bring stories from my own constituents to that discussion. And listening to the testimony today, there's one area that I felt like we still need to do a little work, and I'm hoping Representative Schultz and the others will think about, in that on page 8 under Assisted Living and Home Care Bill of Rights, we have maltreatment defined, and we have it very clear, you know, what the responses are and who you can appeal to and all those sorts of things. But some of the stories that we heard today and stories that I have heard from my constituents are really cases of neglect and failure to perform contractual obligations for the residents of those facilities. When you don't check on someone when you've promised that you will, when you don't take them down to their meal, you know, that can be called, I suppose, maltreatment. The way it's defined, though, is infliction of physical pain or injury, a persistent code of contact intended to produce mental or emotional distress. I have heard from constituents who've had a loved one in assisted living. A spouse told me this story of how her husband was supposed to get, I think, showers at least twice a week. And he wasn't getting that. And they said, well, you know, it's so hard keeping staff around. So she would complain, and then they'd go back to giving him the showers, but she'd find out that one of the neighbors down the hall wasn't getting it. And what was happening for months was just a rotation of neglect, rather than fulfilling their obligations to all the people who were living in that facility. And, you know, missing a shower may not rise to the situation that would be typically defined as maltreatment, but it is definitely not fulfilling your commitment to the safe care and healthy care of those individuals. And, you know, putting someone in the corner of a room and not making sure that they are engaged in activities or have, you know, the kind of supports that they're paying for, many thousands of dollars a month, to me is also potentially an issue that's easier to define as neglect. And so as this continues to move forward and we look at how to make sure that we're addressing all the circumstances that confront people, I hope that we'll look at that as a potential another avenue that we need to have a little bit more clarity, because so many of the stories that I've heard really fall to that level, but might have a harder time in a court of law or other situation to be defined as persistent course of conduct intended to produce mental or emotional distress. Because I think the defense is always, we never intended to distress them. We were just short of staff. Well, if you're short of staff, then you have to stop admissions. And that doesn't seem to be an option that is taken very often. So but otherwise, I think that this is really a good thing, and I really appreciate the work of everyone who's contributed to that. And thank you, Representative Schultz, for your leadership on this.
Thank you so much. Before you respond, Representative Schultz, I had someone from my district who was, like, really concerned about elder abuse, elder care. And one of the things that they asked me that I'm going to put to maybe you or someone from the department is the difference between assisted living and nursing homes, and why is the focus only on assisted living?
Mm-hmm. So, Madam Chair, on your question, we already license nursing homes and regulate nursing homes to a great extent, but we have failed as a state to license and regulate and provide oversight for assisted living facilities. And more, they're becoming more popular, so we're seeing more neglect and abuse and issues there in assisted living. So, but to answer Representative Loeffler's question, I thank you for attending those working group meetings. I was able to get to a few, and it was very impressed with the work that was being done. Especially getting to agreement on licensure. But apparently, according to Representative Freiberg, who's our expert attorney, in line 8.28, section 626.5572 includes neglect. So it's not the language is not directly in the bill. It refers to a section in statute. So.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Freiberg did point that out to me. I always think in the interest of clear statutes, mm-hmm. we probably should look at whether we put maltreatment includes neglect as defined in and goes on, because because I just think as we write up this into common language for the families, it's so typical that we ignore all those numbers and instead just try and summarize the words on the page. But I'm glad to know that we are looking out for that. Thank you to our esteemed lawyer to my left on looking up the cross-reference.
So, Madam Chair, those are good suggestions, so we can modify that.
We have any other questions for members? Representative Addison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Schultz. I just want to say thank you so much for carrying this bill. I can't tell you how much this was an issue in my community. Also, my father-in-law had Alzheimer's, and your testifier, Eric Lynn, really struck a chord with me. I think it's a huge issue in terms of having monitors, evictions. So I'm surprised that we do not have this legislation yet as a freshman. I would also just say on the report card, I know that nursing homes do these. I think they're very imperfect. Mm-hmm. So as we do that, I think that we really have to look at ways where we could have a randomization of when we're coming and doing those checks, because right now the nursing homes are actually getting flagged and saying, hey, you know what, I'm coming, then they staff up. And we're not getting a real picture there. So I just hope that we can do a better job when we're doing this with assisted living facilities. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for that statement. Is there any other questions from members? Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a few questions for the authors of the bill, and then I understand that we have a couple of amendments that we'll be taking up, so I'll try to be brief in my comments. To the authors of the bill, on page 10, and this is pointedly about a couple of definitions that I see overarching in the whole bill. One talks about a designated representative, and another one talks about a resident representative. And so my question is, are they the same? And if they are, why aren't we using just one?
Representative Schultz.
So I'm going to have Ron Elwood answer that question from Legal Aid.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and who you represent and respond to the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Madam Chair and Representative Albright, it's purposeful that there are two different uses. What you'll notice is that designated representative is used in every place except in the electronic monitoring provision. And designated representative includes attorneys, in fact, power of attorney and conservators. And for purposes of advocating for people's rights and things like that, that's appropriate. In terms of placing a camera, the term is used resident representative, which is consistent with the electronic monitoring group's use of that term, because that does not include a conservator or a power of attorney, because they're financial advocates, and that doesn't really fit with placing a camera. So that's a very purposeful distinction.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would disagree, because if you have appointed someone to be your power of attorney, it is not just about a financial question. It is about the safety of the individual. And to suggest that a power of attorney is only relegated to issues of finance and a resident representative is only relegated to those of electronic monitoring, I think we're giving short shrift to a family member who might be designate a power of attorney to someone who has a very strong desire to provide for the safety and well-being of that resident. So to suggest that there should be a difference, I don't find one.
Madam Chair.
You want to respond? Okay.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, clearly we share the same goals to protect the resident's safety. I think maybe there's a distinction between a financial power of attorney and a healthcare power of attorney. And in the resident representative area for the cameras and the monitoring, the healthcare power of attorney, healthcare agent, would be appropriate to in there, and it's included. So, but we should look at that carefully.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, I threw a lifeline to my attorney, in fact, on this committee. I have a contract. I have supported him by buying him a cup of coffee and a dollar bill in his pocket. to the authors, thank you, Madam Chair. On page 24, this is a very expansive delineation and scope. Although the one thing that I don't find is a time frame for hearing resolution. Can you articulate where it is?
Representative Schultz?
Is this the hearings?
Is this the DE1 amendment?
Yes, ma'am. Okay.
Page 24.
What is the question?
Madam Chair, if I might, just to reiterate, I don't find a position in the document where we delineate a time frame for hearing resolution.
Representative, I'm sorry, Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, that there is not a time. It's because we thought that that was, it's calling for an expedited hearing, and that is a term that's been used in several statutes with respect to the Office of Administrative Hearings, and it was thought to allow the Office of Administrative Hearings to determine its own time frame, but expedited means quickly.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, I think when we think without, or the thought being, to use your words, I think we use those at our own peril with regard to the folks that we are relegated to safeguard by putting this type of things in. So it's a positive admonishment that we should clarify that thought in the language itself. And I'm sure I just have one final question for the authors. And this has to do, thank you, Madam Chair, on page 29, and this has to do with the private enforcement of rights. Actually, it's twofold. I have an initial question and then a follow-up. I'm curious, as you put this bill together, either for Representative Olson or Representative Schultz, why you arrived at damages at or established or recoverable actual damages of $3,000, whichever is greater. What prompted the $3,000 value placed in the bill?
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, if you look across Minnesota statutes, there are numerous places where statutory damages are put in place. And they range from $1,000, $2,000, up to $10,000. The kind of the middle ground or the lower part of the middle ground is around $3,000. And so, a number of statutory damage is placed to create a floor that is not too high, not too low, but sufficient enough to deter the behavior that you're trying to deter with a private right of action.
Representative Albright?
Thank you for that answer, because I think it lends itself or segues towards my follow-on, because it also probably attracts frivolous lawsuits, given the fact that if you knew that without any quantifiable damages being incurred, that an attorney might say, you know what, I think you're harmed, and I think it's worth about at least $3,000, but I'm sure I can get more for you. The follow-on effect to that, David, or Representative Pinto is grinning because he knows where I'm going with this. Well, maybe he doesn't. Is you're going to increase the cost of care or cost of caring for people. One, because they're going to have to take out even higher levels of liability insurance to cover the $3,000 times whatever number of residents are staying in that community, and then whatever the actuaries add on top of that to make sure that they're covering their risk for insuring that community of residents. So my concern is that that alone really has a very, to use a overused phrase, chilling effect on taking good care of the people that are entrusted to the care of these residencies. I would also caution both the authors to rethink and to think through that in a more careful manner as you contemplate the coalitions that want to support this bill. I, for one, do as well. But as I've said in community committee before, this is where we get ferocious about the details, because lives are at stake. And we want to make sure that we get it right the first time. We don't have to come back and amend it to the chagrin of those that are looking to us for guidance in terms of how to care for those most vulnerable amongst us. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. So I have two amendments before we have another.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, just a couple of things in response. First of all, that term frivolous lawsuit is thrown around a lot, but I think that's a misnomer and a sort of a red herring for a number of reasons. First of all, under rules of civil procedure, under Rule 11, there is a serious sanction for anybody filing a lawsuit without merit. And almost every attorney in Minnesota will be very careful about filing what would be termed a frivolous lawsuit because they could lose their license. That's number one. Number two, you only get attorney's fees here if you win. So an attorney taking a case with no ability to know whether they're not going to get their attorney's fees unless they win, so they better have a good case to begin with. And second and third of all, last year the bill had a private right for all the rights in the Bill of Rights and the home care and the health care Bill of Rights. And if you'd note, this year there are only a handful of rights on which you would have a private right to enforce them in court. And those are the most serious rights: maltreatment, retaliation, denial of counsel, denial of visitors. Very, very limited private right here. And the last thing I'd say is that with the magnitude of stories we've heard of a violation of the rights, and today there is no recourse. Those rights are just a lot of nice words on a piece of paper. And without having any ability to enforce them by the individual, because the public enforcement not only will never be strong enough, but second of all, it only goes to the facility. It doesn't compensate the victim for the harm they've suffered and doesn't give them justice. So I would say that this is a balancing, and I think we've moved from enforcement of all rights to enforcement of just a handful. There's six rights out of 50-some-odd between the home care and the health care Bill of Rights. Thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No one will dispute the dishonor that has been brought upon these residents. Without hesitation, we agree on that. But we can agree that we also live in a very litigious society. Present company, that being said, if I'm a business owner, I am well-meaning, but if a lawsuit or a piece of litigation is brought upon me with the threat and the onerous nature of defending myself by those rights and by the definitions that we put in this, the resultant action that a business owner might take is to say, let's just settle and move on. And I think that is very concerning to me. No one has any dispute with the inherent rights that these residents have. But I also know there is the dark side, if you will, to placing an opportunity in front of someone to claim something that isn't there without quantifiable damages. So we are in agreement with some caveats that I hope the authors will take under advisement as it moves forward through the process. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for those comments, Representative Albright. We are happy to work with you on that language, and if you recommend a different number there instead of 3,000, we're open to that. And I think the advocates have compromised quite a bit about their rights, and we'll continue to work on this legislation in a bipartisan way with all of the stakeholders.
All right. So I have two amendments before me. I have the A2 amendment, Representative Schultz.
So they're technical amendments. I recommend that we adopt both. I believe there's an A1 and an A or an A2. A1, A2 amendment.
So you are. We have the A2 amendment and an A3 amendment and the DE1.
We already adopted.
Yep. Which you already edit, right, which you already amended onto the original bill.
Yes, so with the DE1, we would like to amend House File 90 that is now amended with DE1. We'd like to amend with the A2, which is technical yes. language, which Thank nonpartisan you. Research staff has recommended that we adopt.
Thank you. Would you like to speak to the amendment? Technical or technical? Okay.
Madam Chair, has someone moved the A2?
No. Do you have someone to move the A2?
I can move the A2.
Representative Schultz moves the A2 amendment. Any comment? Any discussion? All in favor of the A2 amendment say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment has been added on to your bill. Okay, is there any further discussion on the amendment?
Madam Chair.
You want to move to the A3?
I'd like to move the A3 amendment, okay. if I may, Madam Chair.
Okay. So we have Representative Pearson who's moving the A3 amendment. Okay. Who support the A3 amendment, say aye. Any discussion first? Any discussion?
You would like to maybe speak to the
I can speak to the A3, and again, I you know, we're a little over our schedule right now. I know the bill author was really going for a very comprehensive bill here. The one thing that some of the recommendations from the Office of the Legislative Auditor were not included in this language, and so that's what the A3 is remedying. We're basically trying to actually and free up the Office of Health Facility Complaints so that they can actually do or have an easier time doing their job. When they see violations, they can get things done in a timely manner. We're also asking them to be accountable to the legislature as well. So this is actually stuff that has been discussed in the past, and again, with the review of the Office of the Legislative Auditor, these are a lot of the recommendations, and this comprehensively goes through and follows suit with what those recommendations were. I also understand that there's a line item within the governor's budget that allows for these specific activities, so I don't think that there should be much of an objection to following those recommendations.
Representative Zolt, do you have any comments on the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we do have some questions on some of the language, but I encourage members to adopt the A3, and we can fix that in the next committee stop.
Chair Liebling?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I see that Mr. Pollack is there. I think maybe he has a comment to make on this, and I also had a question about it, and notwithstanding that Representative Pearson just said there's a line item in the governor's budget on this, I was wondering whether the amendment has a cost. And I guess that Representative Pearson has some information about that I don't have yet, but maybe we can hear from Mr. Pollack.
Well, see, Representative Pearson, can you
respond? Well, since I was asked the question, but this is a policy committee, so I thought certainly we wouldn't be asked about costs here. It seems like sometimes that's not allowed to be discussed, and now we're asking the question. But it's my understanding that it's a pretty minor, administrative cost that's allowed for in the budget. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be really quick. I know time is short. I just want to draw, overwhelmingly, this language I think was considered last year, and we might have some technical feedback. But the one piece that is, I think, substantive, and I don't know that Representative Pearson meant to, or, you know, was going in this direction, is on page 14, line 15, the change to the data status. And this really is a, you know, Judiciary Committee civil law issue, but since this is the policy committee, I think it's important to raise. Changing the status of the data by the common entry point is really changing who can access information before an investigation has been completed. So the maltreatment is reported to MARC, which is part of DHS, and then what this says is that a person who is a subject, meaning the alleged perpetrator, will be able to access that data before the investigation has been completed, while law enforcement is looking into it, potentially disrupting the investigation by being able to access the information on themselves. So that paragraph B change is pretty kind of a big deal, and I just wanted to alert the committee to it.
Okay. So do we have any, you want to respond to that, Representative Schultz or Chair Liebling?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I see, I think there's also another person who would like to comment on the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Marie Dotseth. I'm an Assistant Commissioner of Health at the Minnesota Department of Health. We want to thank Representative Schultz and agree that in this amendment, I guess substantively, there's a lot that either has been discussed or that we don't have issue with, but there are some details that we would like to continue to work with the author on to make sure that it works and it does align with work that is already underway at the Minnesota Department of Health.
Thank you so much for that testimony. So I think kind of like what I'm hearing, though, although there's some technical revisions that needs to be made, that Representative Schultz is willing to accept the A3 amendments onto our bill.
Correct, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. Is there any further discussion? Representative Bonner.
Just to clarify, so thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Schultz. So if we accept the A3 amendment, I do have some concerns that the gentleman brought up about that B section. Would those be corrected in another stop, or are we allowing those in? Because I think I have some concerns about that as a person who works in IT and does a lot of work with data that has definite concerns for me in terms of privacy and so forth. So I would have some issues with that. I just want to make sure to clarify today, if we accept this amendment, that we will be looking at some revisions to that B section and not passing that through.
Yeah, I think that's a common concern for many of us, but Representative Schultz did state that as the bill moves through the body, that she will work with stakeholders to clear up the language.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the referral was to Judiciary, mm-hmm. where those issues mm-hmm. will be brought up.
Yes, you're correct.
So thank you so much. To placate the concerns by the representative.
Yes.
So, Madam Chair, yes, our intent is to work with the agency staff and make sure that that language is acceptable to the agencies, and we can do that at the next committee stop.
Okay. Any further discussion? Okay, so hearing none, all in favor of adopting the A3 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is now adopted. Okay. So there being no further discussion, Representative Schultz renews her motion that House File 90 as amended be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Judiciary. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. House 590 as amended is recommended for re-referral to the Committee of Judiciary. Your bill is on its way. Thank you all so much. We are adjourned.